Well, let's see. Today is the 19th of August, 1971, and I've got Mrs. Lola C. Tilley here in the office, and she and I are going to talk a little bit about the early days and Dr. Bunnell. Lola, by golly, let's relax now.
That's right. This goes back to about January 1930. When I was teaching at the University of Minnesota, my department head came down to my office and said, "How would you like to go to Alaska? Here's a letter from the president, Dr. Bunnell. He's in Washington, D.C. now, and he has chosen the University of Minnesota as a place where he'd like to find two home economics teachers for his college up there."
Now, what year was this, Lola?
This was in early 1929. And so I said, "Fine, I'd like to see him." And it seems that he was in Washington trying to get legislation for the university. So he appeared on the scene very soon, and he interviewed people all afternoon, and finally they called me, and of course I say he interviewed me. He did the talking, as you know Dr. Bunnell does, and I was completely fascinated by his account of the university and the enthusiasm he had for it. Well, anyway, he said, "Now, the job is yours if you would like to come." And I said, "Well, Dr. Bunnell, I would like very much to come to the University of Alaska, but, you know, I couldn't stay but 1 year, and I don't think this would be fair to you." "Oh, well," he said, "if you didn't want to stay the second year, we wouldn't want you." And I often thought of that psychology of his.
Sure.
Well, that night he was invited to the home management house for dinner. I wasn't there, but the girls told me that he was absolutely fascinating. He had, of course, with him the scrapbook showing the activities on the campus, but as you know, there was no one more charming as a dinner guest than Dr. Bunnell. Well, he didn't say to me, "Here, now sign this contract." I think I'm sure I wouldn't have signed it. Anyway, he went on to Juneau to meet with the legislature at that time. And in Juneau, he wrote a wonderful letter and said nothing about my signing a contract. And it was not, and of course he stayed until the legislature was over. As a matter of fact, he told about how the they turned the clock back.
That was almost a usual procedure, you know. They never got around to passing the money bill till the last minute, and then they run out of time.
That's right. Well, they often talk about the legislator who was always saying, "Well, that's Dr. Bunnell's $50,000 woodshed up there in Fairbanks."
Yeah.
Well, anyway, then it was not until he returned, which was probably March, to the university, that he wired me the contract and asked for an acceptance and told me to bring somebody with me as another teacher in home economics. Well, by that time I decided that since I wouldn't have to stay more than 1 year, I'd give it a try. And so in those were the days we came by steamship, and my home was in southern Illinois, and it took 2 weeks to get from my home up to Fairbanks, because I had to go by train and Pullman to Seattle, and the boats left only on Saturday once a week.
9 o'clock Saturday morning.
That's right, with all of the confetti and all the activity, and I might say that I had a telegram on board wishing me a bon voyage in the land of many men, and this was quite the joke. You know that we, in those days, you had to stay overnight at Curry, but for some reason the schedule worked out that we stayed overnight in Anchorage, and then overnight in Curry. And so when we got here, that was on a Sunday night. Why, Dr. Minnell had Vima Sammons, who was dormitory hostess at that time. You may remember her.
No, I don't.
She got on the train here at college. That was a college station at that time. And accompanied us in to the Fairbanks and took us to the Nordale Hotel and out to dinner. This was one of Dr. Minnell's little hospitalities. He wouldn't come to dinner, but he would see that somebody took us to dinner. But he was waiting at the hotel when we returned to give us the welcome. And the next morning, he sent a car in to pick us up to take us to the university.
Now, this us, did you bring somebody
yes,
with you?
Yes, I brought my office mate, Aline Sewell.
Sewell. Oh, you brought her along
yes,
with you?
Yes, I was to choose someone.
Yeah.
And she was sharing the same office and working on her teaching and working on her master's degree,
yeah,
which she received that next year.
Uh-huh.
So, as you know, I don't think Dr. Minnell could drive, as you, since you were a chauffeur at
I don't think he ever drove in
well
his
anyway Liz Grigsby, one of the students, was his official chauffeur then, and she came in the next morning to bring us out to the university. And those were the days when we had that little narrow road through the peat bog where there was a turnout. Two cars couldn't pass.
That's right.
And I thought, what am I getting into here? I was not used to that type of forestry, and it was the most godforsaken country I'd ever seen, with only two or three houses between Fairbanks and the university. Well, anyway, that was my first introduction. Dr. Bunnell, of course, was very eager to have us well established, and the only place that we could find to live was at the Nordale Hotel. Rooms were then $45 a month, and we ate at the Model Cafe across the street. That old road, as you know, was served for passenger cars. However, we did not even have a bus at that time. We came to the university on the Brill car, 15 cents a trip, and if you bought books of coupons, why, the trip was 25 cents a round trip.
Oh,
it was later that we had a bus, Paul Griman's bus, which was broken down half the time, I think. But that was quite an innovation. And on occasion, the road would wash out. And one of the professors, you remember Chase, Professor Chase, stood there and carried the women across the washout to the other side where there was a bus waiting. Well, we...
Do you remember what year, Lola, the bus started operating? Was it that year?
Well,
you came in 29.
I came in August of 29.
So.
And it was probably in 31,
yeah,
I would say.
Around there. I would guess that too. I'm not sure.
Around that time. And of course, there was one thing I didn't, I guess I didn't have much vision for the future of Alaska, but I certainly didn't ever expect to have any blacktop roads.
No.
This, we were mired down in the mud, but I thought that was, as they say, par for the course.
Yeah.
And to me, one of the finest things that ever happened to us was the blacktop roads, and especially between Fairbanks and the university. At that time, there was just the old main building where Bunnell, approximately where Bunnell Building is now, and two frame dormitories, men's dormitory and women's dormitory. The president's house was down on the corner as you turn in to the drive in front of Eielson Building. You know that president's house is now houses the home management house up on the hill by the Harwood Hall.
Yeah, right behind the fire hall.
Right? That's right, yeah. In there. Uh-huh. And they could not get funds for building a home management house. But they were able to renovate that. The faculty, I was quite impressed with the faculty, very high caliber.
Mm-hmm.
They had all traveled at some place. You recall Professor Bastus and mm-hmm. Professor Potts had both taught over at Roberts College in Syria, and their wives mm-hmm. had been teachers and Red Cross workers, and Dr. Ryan had taught in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just recently traveled in Europe, and so it was a well-traveled faculty, and a very good faculty. I was impressed by the hospitality in town, and the fact that everybody attended everything and entered into the community activities. Of course, that time there were only four churches, the Catholic, the Episcopal, and the Christian Science, and the Presbyterian. It was the Presbyterian that I attended, and I think that is rather historical because the church was the one that S. Hall Young founded back in 1907, I think it was, and that's the one that's out at Alaska Land now.
Oh, yeah.
And they moved it out there, and it has been a center of interest since it's moved. Well, Dr. Monell was great. He, of course, went around in old tennis shoes and old clothes, and especially in the summer. And one time, and he would conduct the tourists around, and one time one of the tourists offered him a tip, and he took it. It was a dollar. You know, that was typical of Dr. Monell. And they didn't know that they had tipped the president of the university. Another thing about Dr. Monell, he was out there doing everything. And I said to him one day, I would like to get some vegetables for my foods class. There's a nice vegetable garden on the hill here. I wonder if I could get some. Well, that would be fine. And the next thing I knew, he was out there digging the vegetables. If you can imagine the president of the university digging the vegetables for the home economics class. He was.
Was it his own garden?
He yeah. had planted the garden right on the hillside there,
yeah.
Approximately where Bonnell Building stands now.
Well, it was not by his house, but
no,
a little
no.
further
oh,
up.
Oh, no. He yeah. had taken advantage of
nice
the
south
hillside. he was a man of vision, as I've said before. He could see the this become a great university. Nobody else could. He could visualize the building between college and the university, and that was hard to visualize. He took a very special interest in the students and was ready with a loan, made many, many personal loans. He was interested in their academic achievements, and he had very high standards, but he realized that many of the students did not have the academic background. So one of the innovations at that time was to have a study hall, if you could imagine that, in a university. And so the people on the flunk list were invited to attend this study hall. And I recall some of the people that are now very outstanding and who have done well and who are teaching and librarians in universities were on that list. And he had faith in the students. Of course, we took turns monitoring this study hall. Dr. Bonnell was on the job 24 hours a day, actually. He just, I don't know when he ever slept. And he thought the university faculty should keep hours. We took the Brill car from Fairbanks at 7 o'clock in the morning. If you can imagine any faculty getting here, it took about 15 minutes on the car. And any time you thought, well, I guess I'll take the next Brill car, you would find Dr. Monell standing in the hall with his watch in his hand. So with a guilty conscience, you would go up. And he always knew what you were doing and if you were late. And, of course, on occasion, I would take my classes into town for a field trip. And it never failed if I had my class on a 1 o'clock bus at around the noon hour. It never failed. Dr. Monell was always on that bus, and he was looking to see and asking, you might say, why? Why are you on the bus this time of day?
I know how you feel.
He was really pleased with the equipment we had, such as it was, but actually for that year, which was the year of 1929, the equipment was pretty good. And in spite of the lack of some equipment, we were able to work out a pretty good program. We had an old DC electric range and a DC Hobart mixer, which we used, but we had those Carragas kerosene stoves.
Uh-huh.
Now, they had portable ovens, and really, they baked very well, but you really had to know how to manage them. There was a coal stove, and I must say that I wondered how we were going to manage this old coal stove on the top floor of the building. And so I inquired, and I think I perhaps had a look of dismay, because not long after that stove was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew where it was, what happened to that stove, but Dr. Bunnell took it upon himself to move that stove out during the wee hours of the morning when nobody knew. Now, we didn't even have a refrigerator, but we had a cooler in those days, those coolers in the wall with an outside top and bottom ventilator, and that really
was just a ventilator,
circulating
with some of the air from outside.
That's right.
Not even any ice in it.
Oh no,
circulating.
Yes, and actually it worked very well.
Yeah.
But and of course we nobody knew what a freezer was, and so we used the great outdoors for freezing, and that was the fire escape. You recall the fire escape. From the top
Well, you that made use of these this frozen foods business long before
that
it came.
That was before Birdseye came in, and I recall that, and we did quite a bit of experimenting with frozen foods, putting them out on the fire escape and testing them out. And when I went back to University of Minnesota, I always thought I had to take trips to the different universities, you know, to get up to date. We were so afraid we'd be up to date. And Miss McNeil, who was chief of the division there at University of Minnesota, said, well, you know, Lola Tilley's been doing freezing of foods and experimenting up there with wild berries and everything all these years. This is nothing new for her. She'd been freezing pies and cakes and everything. And then she said, too, they are doing things up there that we haven't been able to get around to because of red tape and the large department and everything. And said, for instance, she talks about individual needs and adapting courses to the individual needs of the students, and we haven't gotten around to that yet. Of course, this made me feel good.
Sure.
We used to grab the fashion magazines every time they arrived to see if we were getting out of date, and so we did pretty well on that, I think. Of course, those were the days when we didn't have a budget. There wasn't any such thing as a budget at the university. I don't know that Dr. Monell even had a budget.
Well, the budget was assumed to be zero.
Well,
know,
and it was known as the Dole system. And it was just like asking your father for a nickel or your husband. And so if I wanted to buy something, I had to ask. And it was not until years later, really in the 50s, late 50s, that they actually set up a budget for the department.
Yeah.
And, of course, a secretary for the department, my goodness, you couldn't even get secretarial work down in the office. Dr. Monell was just aghast at the objective tests that we wanted mimeographed. I don't think he ever heard of an objective test. And this was something new that we had brought from the outside. And so we scrounged and passed copies around. But we didn't even have phones. There was a phone on the floor of the third story, but you used that only for business. And then you had to ring Central.
Yeah.
And those were the days when you asked Central for the number, and there were no numbers. You asked by name.
Yeah.
For instance, Mrs. Hess, Dr. Monell was always a little annoyed that he couldn't find Mrs. Hess, who was then secretary, had been secretary of the Board of Regents all those years. But you would call Central and say, well, I'd like to get hold of Mrs. Hess. Well, dearie, this is her bridge day, but I'll call you and call her at Mrs. Clark's, Minnie
mm-hmm.
Clark's. She'll be there.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way we were able to get hold of people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a popular course in those days called Camp Cookley.
I want you to tell about that.
Yes, you recall Camp Cookley. Of course, in those days, in order to get on the books, there was much scrounging to get registration, and so the short mining short course was a big event in the mid-year, and it was a big event for the miners who could come in and live at the dormitory and board there and take courses. And the courses were very good, and of course one of the, and I say good because I taught Camp Cookley, and they thought it was good, but it was not my first introduction to teaching Camp Cookery, because I had taught the foresters at the University of Minnesota and had large classes there, and we did outdoor cooking and did a lot there. But it was my first course here, and the first day we met, here were these burly sourdoughs sitting around, and one of them said to me, now, if you were out in the bush and you wanted to make biscuit and you had no equipment, no utensils, how would you do it? And he was so sincere, and I thought, well, now, I'll just do the best I can. And I said, well, I would take the sack of flour and roll down the top and make a depression in the center, and put in there my baking powder and salt and the fat, and work it around, and put in the powdered milk and add the flour and stir up the dough, and put it in the oven or the reflector oven, or bake it on a stick over the coals. And he sat there, and he was so sincere and so interested, and he kept nodding his head and nodding his head. And when I got through, he sat back and drew a sigh of relief. He said, that's right, I just wanted to find out if you knew. And so I had made the grade. I was accepted, and anything I said was okay for the rest of the term. And we had a wonderful time, and they taught me things, and I think I taught them something. In fact, later on, in some of the regular students in Camp Cookery were able to get jobs. You recall Tim Twitchell, Well, he bragged about the fact that he put himself through school cooking at a road commission camp because of the know-how that he got in camp cookery. I thought that was pretty good. And then, of course, you remember Allie Murphy, the only Negro student, our first Negro graduate. Well, he, on the strength of his camp cookery, he got several jobs as cook and cooked over here at the food service, and now is the head man in charge of the food service for Universal Foods all through the North Sloop on the line up there. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, there were many. I should tell about these fellows who lived in the dorm, and one man lived in a shack up way up on the hill. You remember the ex-preacher? I've forgotten his name. Anyway, he lived in this shack way up on the hill behind the food service. Mm-hmm. You know, the dining room, mm-hmm. kitchen, we're on the lower floor, mm-hmm. of what was the girls' dormitory at that time. Well, anyway, they gave him leftover food in these number 10 cans, and he would take them up to his shack, mm-hmm. and freeze them. So he was doing a little food freezing there. So he would empty these cans on the boxes and stumps all around his cabin. So you could go up there and see. Here would be weenies and sauerkraut, over here macaroni and cheese, and here would be spaghetti, and over here would be a stack of hotcakes, and here a stack of biscuit. And when he was ready to eat, he'd just hack off some sauerkraut.
I don't remember his name.
I can't.
Was it a Russian name?
No, I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so. Well, anyway, you recall Dr. Fred Beeler, who was a student here at that time, and he worked in the food service for Miss Luke. Uh-huh. Miss Luke, who was such a wonderful cook and took such pride in the students. Well, she would let him take some leftover food, and he had a leftover pie one day, which he set out in the back where this leftover food was. And when he went out, of course, the pie was gone, and the old man had taken it up to the hill. Well, you recall those campus activities where everybody took part, and the gym was on the third floor of the old main building. And that's where we had the dances, and everybody went, faculty and students. And of course, we always had refreshments, and refreshments were prepared down the hall in the home economics department. Mm-hmm. And of course, we didn't know what large quantity electric percolators were in those days. We had to heat the water on the old kerosene stove.
Yeah.
In a great big kettle, and took forever.
Yeah.
Had to get it on early. You remember that?
Oh yeah. Well,
and put the coffee in
the
cloth bag, and tie it up. Somebody would invariably get it tied too tight, and then it wouldn't diffuse.
Circulate. Yeah. That's right.
Well, I was going to say that we had the dances up there, and of course. Students didn't know what corsages were then. They didn't have to worry about spending money for corsages. It was not until one year, we didn't have any greenhouses, of course. One year, the first corsages that were flown in, that was in later years, were some violets that they sent in for the junior prom.
Oh,
I don't know whether you remember that or not, but this was quite an event. The plays, some of the plays were there, and of course faculty took part. I recall your part in the faculty plays or student plays.
We had both the one-act assembly plays.
That's right.
As
and
well
then,
as the town.
And, well, and at the Empress Theater in town, we had the big plays.
Yeah.
And of course, believe it or not, I did the makeup. We all had to do something.
Sure.
And
with the costumes and the makeup.
Yes, costumes, and even participated. I usually had a part too. There was no snack bar at that time, transportation, but we did have a taxi run by students.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, at one time we had two cars, and they often made trips at night to go in to get sandwiches from the Model Cafe. Well, I shouldn't overlook the collegian at that time, because this was your baby for a long time.
Yeah.
But Dr. Minnell used to sit in his office day after day addressing collegians by hand. People wondered why he didn't get help on that, or why it wasn't done on the typewriter. But I think that was sort of a therapy for him, to just sit and address those collegians. When I think of him sitting at his desk, do you recall the time that his office floor had been refinished, and he noticed that some cracks were there on this new floor, and he was trying to find out who made those tracks, and he was accusing everybody, and finally looked at his own shoes, and he was the one that made the tracks.
The varnish was still a little sticky.
That's right. Of course, he was a great detective.
Yeah.
He was always trying to find out who did what,
yeah.
And he usually did. I recall it at the time. See, when we came up from the Brill car, which was station, College Station, was located down approximately where the University Greenhouse
yeah.
is now. Well, that was a long trip mm-hmm. way up the hill, and finally we got electric lights put in along there, and somebody was turning off those lights, and Dr. Minnell suspected that it might be young Ernest Patty. So he saw him on the campus one day, and he said, "Ernest Jr., when did you turn off those lights last night?" And Ernest, caught unaware, said, "Oh, about 6 o'clock." And I thought, Dr. Minnell wasn't a criminal lawyer?
Yeah, that's right. Or, you knew the criminal mind.
anyway, and this is the way he tricked his faculty many, many times. He would come up during the noon hour and snoop around and look to see if you had a vase of flowers on a freshly varnished table.
Yeah.
And if so, he would put something under the vase. He didn't miss a thing. There were many firsts that year. That was the year the Russian fur ship was caught in the ice.
Oh, yeah.
Over in the ice jam near the coast of Russia.
Yeah, the Nanuk,
and,
I think.
Yes, and Colonel Ben Eielson went over, and he made several trips.
Yeah.
And it was went on one of those many trips that he was killed. And of course, we didn't have airplanes coming in and out then, so the Canadians and the Russians together got together their rescue ships mm-hmm. and had a real cooperative thing going there. And they shipped in the Fairchilds over Alaska steamship.
Yeah.
See.
Yeah.
Nobody flew anything in then. Yeah. They came by boat and train
mm-hmm.
and assembled them here.
Yeah.
And then on one of the test hops,
mm-hmm.
We were living there at the Nordale, mm-hmm. Where the pilots were. They invited us to go along on a test hop.
Mm-hmm.
It was not my first plane ride, but I think my second.
Mm-hmm.
And other thing that was rather interesting was, of course, I said there were not any greenhouses. So instead of taking flowers to the girls, the men took fruit. So it was nothing to find a basket of fruit
uh-huh.
or a cake from a bazaar
uh-huh.
as a token of esteem.
Yeah.
That summer when I went back to teach at the University of Minnesota in summer school, when I was asked to give a talk there, one of the students came up to me and said, do the men still take bananas to their girlfriends? and she said, is Bobby Sheldon still the eligible bachelor out there? So news had perked a little bit. One of the real privileges I had during my time was working with Otto Geist. He was here when I arrived, and Dr. Monell had personally financed these expeditions to St. Louis Island, mm-hmm. and the basement of the old main building was used to collect these artifacts, mm-hmm. and that was Dr. Geist's office, mm-hmm. workshop, and museum, mm-hmm. and so he and I worked together down there in that old museum and did a lot of research on the artifacts, which led me under Dr. Bunnell's guidance and prodding mm-hmm. to write four different articles. Mm-hmm. One was on the Eskimo food habits, one on Eskimo clothing, mm-hmm. Eskimo homes, and Eskimo children's toys. Mm-hmm. And then I had all the illustrations and all the materials there, mm-hmm. and together with Otto.
Those were published in the Collegian, I remember.
They were published in the Journal of Home Economics.
Oh, were they too?
Dr. Bunnell personally took those back to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. and interviewed the editor, and they were published, one at a time through that. Back in 1930, we didn't know everything there was to be known about nutrition, mm-hmm. but my University of Illinois professor, professor of bioscience and nutrition, had found that article on food habits and nutrition mm-hmm. In the journal and wrote to me specially saying what a fine mm-hmm. Thing it was.
Sure.
So I felt that we made some contribution.
Sure.
Dr. Mandel didn't miss a thing.
His interests were
broad.
Whole width of everything, all knowledge, really.
In fact, you'd be surprised how much he knew and what he knew, because one time he called me into his office. And he had the Journal of Home Economics, not for those articles, in front of him. And he also had the book, Marshall's Arctic Village.
Mm-hmm.
You recall that?
Yeah.
Book. And I had published in the journal a list of books on Alaska. And the reason I had that is because they were going to have the convention, American Home Economics Convention in Seattle, and they thought some people might want to come on to Fairbanks, and they asked me to furnish a list for the journal. And Iris Ryan, Dr. Ryan's wife, was librarian at that time, so I consulted her, and this list was a joint venture, and in that list, she had listed The Arctic Village by Marshall, and said it was a sociological study.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Bunnell had this in front of him,
yeah.
and he said to me, how could you possibly put such a book in this list and publish it? Don't you know that is a little risque? And he read parts of the book, and he said, and his voice trembled, how can I go to the legislature and ask for money when you are a faculty member recommending such
this
a book?
Turns, yeah.
And of course the book turned out to be a very fine source.
Yeah.
However, I listened and was somewhat awed, but I said to him, Dr. Bunnell, how many people on the legislature and in the state of Alaska are going to look into the Journal of Home Economics? Well, that held him, and it did not interfere with his ability to get money. However, it was very difficult to get money. He did very well, and it was through his insight and that we were able to really develop. Dr. Bunnell had great influence over everyone and over his faculty in a sort of an indirect way. You may recall that he was greatly afraid of flying. He would not get into an airplane. And even after the plane service came in, he would take the boat. And one time, you recall, Carl Franklin was, who's now vice president at California, the University of California, LA, I think it is. He was BA instructor and later registrar, I think, for a while. Wanted to go outside by plane, and so he had chartered a plane to Cordova, and then we were to take the boat at Cordova.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this would shorten the trip.
Yes, and days. Then it would be interesting scenery and everything, and so he talked me into this and enough to make a charter trip.
Yeah.
And it was all arranged. Dr. Bunnell heard about it, and he was not going to have any of his faculty flying that hazard. And he was simply aghast. And he didn't say, you can't go, but he made it known that he did not approve.
That's right.
In fact, we went on the train to Seward and took the boat to Seward. Carl Franklin was absolutely physically sick over that, because Dr. Bunnell, as you know, could put the fear of something into it. Dr. Bunnell, of course, went back to Washington to get money on the Smith Lever funds.
Mm-hmm.
Those were funds for establishing the Extension Service.
Oh, yeah.
And they said to him, why, the Extension Service, Agricultural Cooperative Extension, that's for rural areas. And he said, and you don't have any farming to speak of up there, you don't have rural areas. But he said, well, all of Alaska is rural, really. Our towns are rural, and we need the extension service up there. And so he was able to get funds for the extension service. At that time, he asked me if I would do something with the extension service in the summer, but I was going outside on that summer, trip, and so they did get the fund, and Dr. Gasser was the first director of Extension.
Mm-hmm.
He was the head of agriculture here on the campus, and then Lydia von Hansen, who was one of the early professors of home economics, became the first director of Extension Service in home economics. But that was only one of the many visions that Dr. Bunnell had. He also not only had high academic standards, but he felt that we should do what other universities do. So he had formal commencements. We didn't have a marshal then,
know.
And that's why it was not nearly as effective as it is now with Marshall Cashin. But he would have a formal commencement with the faculty in academic gowns when the faculty outnumbered the graduates.
Mm-hmm.
But he stuck to it. Many people thought that was a bit strange. And then, of course, he had hoped that we would get to the point where we would be accredited. And 1935 was a proud day when Dean Bolton came and said we had finally arrived where we could be the University of Alaska. And so Dr. Manel naturally was very proud of that. The first concrete building on the campus was what is now the museum, and that was the gym.
Was that about under construction when you arrived?
No. It was not until, well, I don't have the exact date, but it was in the 30s.
31, 32, someplace in there.
Yes. Yeah. And then it was just for the gym. And that's when they moved the gym out of the third top floor of the Allison building. Of course, when we had commencement in the gym, they always had to take the windows out because to get rid of the sweatshirt smells.
The last commencement we
had there was in 1963 when I retired.
We had in 62 we had the commencement up in the old place up in the, it was still the gymnasium.
That's right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and that was 62. Then in 63 we moved down to the other place.
That's right.
Now was it that year that you retired?
That was right in 63, uh-huh. And I was thinking of that only because I recall these commencements in the old gym and. Then there was a period in between there when they had commencement in the library. See, they had the library over the gym.
Mm-hmm.
They moved the library out of the old Bunnell building. And it was a period in between when we had the commencement up there. Well, I was talking about the day that the college became a university in 1935. Then, as you recall, Dr. Bunnell had very definite notions about marriage and married faculty. Women on the faculty were just not to be married.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some kind of unwritten law there which said if you got married, that was the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was married in 1937 to Gray Tilly, I knew, of course, that was the death sentence for being on the faculty. I didn't even question it. In fact, I hadn't even considered working. And I knew that Dr. Manel had these very definite notions. So I wanted him to be the first to know. And so he was at the legislature that spring when we were making our plans. And so I wrote to him, telling him about my plans for getting married at after commencement. In fact, we were married on commencement today.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was the only one that knew about it those months in between. And when he came back, you know, he was chuckling and he would laugh to himself. You know, he was very proud to think he was in on
he liked to be informed on those things.
He liked to be informed. So he never did say a word against the marriage, you see. Then I was not teaching, and then along came the war. And that was when the military took over the university, and we were pressed into, really, into the Eielson building there. That's when Dr. Minnell called me, and that's when Gray, of course, thought he had to fight a Second World War, and he went out hoping to get back into the Navy. And Dr. Minnell called and said, you better come out. And when I came out to see him, I stayed for the rest of the day and went to work for the extension service. He didn't say a word about being married then.
No.
By the way, he always said he would never pay women as much as he would pay men for the same job on the faculty.
Oh,
yes, this is one of his so-called hang-ups. So I worked for the extension service for the for that rest of that year, 1942, and for that summer in the fall of 1943, went back as head of the home economics department, as I was before. There was great pressure to close the university, and if it hadn't been for Dr. Bunnell, there wouldn't be a university here. They would have closed it, and then it wouldn't have reopened, really.
That was during the war.
This was during the war. The military had a contract, and they took over all of the old main building. They took over Hess Hall, which had been built as a women's residence at that time. However, they did reserve the lower floor for the university, the lower floor of the old main building, and that's where we moved the home economics department and the chemistry.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that, but you did. You moved from the top floor down to the basement then for those war years.
That's right. But he always took a great deal of pride in the home economics department, and he did quite a bit of remodeling, refurnishing, so we had a rather nice small department down there. And the girls all moved back then to the old club dorm, they called it. I always say I had all the girls, the students from the dorm for dinner one night, all nine of them. That's how many girls were there. We had night classes, we had to teach at night, we had short courses, you see, we did everything to keep the enrollment up. And that was the first year that we had a woman for a student body president. You remember Elizabeth Bradford? Was the student body president, and that's when we had commencement in the library. Then in 1944, the military had a hospital over at Hess Hall, and they had barracks and a dining room, mess hall, on the top floor of Old Main. And so we moved back then in 1944, and we had a great revision and greatly expanded department. We took over across the hall where the chemistry department was, and Dr. Bunnell was very much interested in this whole department and expanding the program and expanding the facilities. The Eielson building was built in the late 30s, you know, and then that's when they had the museum on the second floor, and the middle floor was the administration. Dr. Minnell moved his office over there. A controller and registrar and extension service were across the hall on the second floor there, and there was there was only the basement floor of the extended part on the other end. And on that lower basement floor, they had the snack bar and the post office and the bookstore. And later, they put a frame second floor on top of that Eielson basement. Mm-hmm. And that was used as a dormitory for faculty and staff. And that became Unit 5, which was moved next door, and I guess was the last frame building to be demolished here, it seems to me, because that was used then for the extension service. And they had plans for extending the Eielson building, building two floors on top of this basement floor, the floor that now extends toward the new office building.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had blueprints for that, and all of a sudden funds became available, this was in 1949, for that.
Mm-hmm.
And because there were blueprints there for a home economics department, and because Dr. Manal was so interested in that, why, they just scooped that up and put in a home economics department. It's true that we didn't have anything to say about the designing of it.
Yeah.
It was designed by someone who didn't understand. And I must say that there was no door between the what we call the little unit kitchen there and the food lab and what we call the home economics lounge.
Yeah.
And I said, we have to have a door here. And they said, you cannot make changes if it isn't on the blueprint. Why, that would cost money. I said, if it does cost money, what of it?
Yeah.
What if it costs $25? What, whatever it costs, we have to have a door. So Dean Nuckring, who was looking after the construction in those days, finally talked them into
putting
a door in, which was the best thing that happened. You know, that was... was not a case of hindsight. Well, it was hindsight for them, but I never would have gotten the door in. And you can imagine what that would have been without a door there to the lounge, which was used by every department on the campus. It was the showplace of the campus, that so-called home economics.
And has for 20 years, I guess.
Yes.
And more facilities. That was the only social.
The only place.
Place.
And it was beautifully furnished because the money that came included furnishings. So I spent all...
Yeah, I think that was some of that FHA or PWA or some kind of federal funding that we got.
And I know that I spent all my summer and all my extra hours, I don't know how Gray lived with me, poring over catalogs and getting everything down by catalog number and color and samples and everything from the furnishings to teaspoons in the lab. And it was nicely furnished and everybody appreciated it. So it was in 1960 that we moved into that new department, and it has functioned with some revisions ever since. And that's when Ivor Scarlin moved anthropology in next door to us. So he always felt that he had a part in the home economics department. It was in 1955 that we had the accreditation team come again to see if we could still be a university and so forth. And we did pass again with flying colors, and we did have a professor of home economics from Idaho on the team who came to inspect our department, and she gave us a very good report, very high rating, but said that we did need a nursery school and a home management house.
Uh-huh.
And both of those we acquired then within the next few years.
Yeah.
The nursery school in across the hall there in our department, which was there until the fire inspector said we must move it out.
Oh.
Do they have it now?
It's now temporarily in the home management house. And Dr. Monell was interested in that. However, it was Dr. Patty that was during his routine that we got the home management house.
Yeah.
And he's really responsible for the home management house, which was beautifully done in the what was the lower floor of the old president's house.
Yeah, when they moved that up there. It was about 55 or so, was it?
Well,
56.
Yeah, around, yes, later, 56 or so,
mm-hmm.
During Dr. Patty's regime.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still a home management house, but temporarily they are using it for the nursery school, and the nursery school, of course, is a teaching aid. The students use it in the child development classes,
mm-hmm.
and it has been a very fine addition.
Yeah.
And nowadays, where preschool education is has such a prominent place, we feel that that's one of our greatest accomplishments,
mm.
and it is now developing to the point where they're going to have an associate degree in child development, a two-year program with an associate degree,
mm-hmm.
because there is quite a demand.
Is there an opportunity for that kind of for nursery school attendance? They don't have to be.
Definitely.
Yeah, I
yes.
see.
So they
could get some kind of certified and that sort of thing,
yes.
with a two-year.
Yes, and the daycare centers.
Yeah.
And these days of working mothers, they
good thing.
There's a big push to get more daycare centers and more nursery schools, and of course the schools are emphasizing the need for pre-nursery school training these days. Takes me through the era of home economics in the Eielson building, which brings me up, of course, to Dr. Wood's era and my retirement.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say that one of the fringe benefits of retiring is having so many of our students and former students in the state,
mm-hmm.
and I always say it's populated not only with my children but my grandchildren, and
mm-hmm.
all I have to do is stand on the street corner in any town in Alaska and see the former students go by. One of my, and of course in the early days we knew everybody by name, and I was caught up short one day when a student in the hall said to me, "Who are you?"
Mm-hmm.
I began to realize that we were really getting big. However, when I speak of the old days, I would not wish the old days on anyone, because I'm just thrilled to death to be part of history in the making and to see our great university. I started to mention the students, and I always am interested in some of the remarks. One of the former students, one of our graduates, said to me when I retired, in fact this was Rose Ringsted, said, "You were the determining factor in my decision to remain in Alaska and graduate at the University of Alaska." She was a transfer, and she came up to on a visit,
yeah.
and came out and saw what she liked, and
yeah.
she said it was through my encouragement. Of course, you know, this is always a delight to a teacher's heart.
Yeah,
and she said, "I want you to know that you are actually responsible for our three families, because you see, her her two sisters came up and were married here, and she married one of
yeah.
our graduates.
Yeah.
And you are responsible for our three families, mine and my two sisters, with our 24 children, your grandchildren." I thought that was
pretty cute.
That was pretty
yeah,
good.
Very good.
Well, I was going to say that Dr. Bunnell, of course, had the vision, and was fortunate in having Dr. Moore carry on with many innovations, and he made a great contribution to the university, followed by Dr. Patty, who was instrumental in getting a lot of the physical plant changed. He always regretted that he couldn't raise our salaries, but he did get us started on the physical change, which was in the right direction. And then came Dr. Wood, and so I have served under all four presidents. And I'm still definitely interested in the university. In fact, I took 6 credits in summer school this summer to...
That's what someone said, that you were back as a student now.
to update my teaching certificate, because since I retired in 63, I have been doing substitute teaching in the public schools in Fairbanks. Everyone says, oh, you substitute at the university. I always say, they don't need substitutes out there. And I have substituted everything from kindergarten through 12th and every subject in high school. And I find it very challenging, and I'm getting a liberal education. And it's fun having not only the children, but the grandchildren of my former students. Yeah. Well, to learn how to be a better substitute teacher and to update my teaching certificate, I took 6 credits in summer school, and it was fun. I really enjoyed it, and it was very exciting. Well, I was going to say that when Dr. Wood came, I knew that I was going to be retiring in 2 years, so I thought it only fair to him to tell him of my plans. And those were the days when there was no tenure.
Yeah.
They were beginning to talk about it, and to me, tenure really meant nothing. I always thought if you were doing a job, you would have tenure, and you didn't worry about it. And I assumed that I was doing a job that was creditable. Well, anyway, I could see that Dr. Wood had a very good sense of humor. So I one day went in to his office, and I said, Dr. Wood, I wanted you to know that I'm feeling very insecure. After these 40 years at the university, I just don't feel very secure because I don't have tenure. And of course, he was wondering why I didn't feel secure. Well, I've never lived that down. He still says to me, how's your tenure? And when I was at the commencement, well, I started to say, I told him then of my plans to retire.
Yeah.
And I feel it a great privilege to have that 2 years working with him, because I think that he is really tops. Well, about this tenure, when I then retired in 63 and was given the status of Professor Emeritus and the honorary doctorate.
Was that at the same time?
Yes.
Did you get your honorary doctorate the same year you retired?
The same time in 63.
Very nice.
And as usual, they have they read the citations, and before he read the citation, Dr. Manel turned to the Dr. Wood, pardon me. Turned to the faculty who were sitting just below the stage, and said, including me, he said, Mrs. Tilley, I understand that you are retiring because you don't have tenure. And he emphasized the word tenure, looking at the faculty. And so everybody got quite a kick out of that.
Yeah.
Of course, I think nowadays people are finding that tenure has its drawbacks as well as its advantages, and probably
it's a two-way street. All right.
That's right. Well, anyway, during the citation, it was getting a little emotional, of course, as sometimes I do. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends in the audience said, she turned to her neighbor and said, "Now, if Dr. Wood would only kiss her." And about that time, he gave me a great big hug and kiss right on the stage, which, of course, was very touching. And you came along.
Yeah, I guess I was there.
And too. Put the academic hood on, and that helped my old friend, the now Marshall Passion. By the way, I understand that you could hardly wait for me to retire so you could become the senior member of the faculty.
I was waiting for that.
Yes. Well, okay, senior member. Of course, you know, for years I used to say, I'm the senior member of the faculty in years of service.
I'll have to add
yes,
that, you know.
In years of service. Yeah. And I emphasize that because I didn't want anybody to know how old I was. And so finally got to the point where I would say, I'm the senior member of the faculty, and that was it, period. Because then, for some time, I was a senior member, not only in years of service, but in age.
Well, I hadn't figured that out,
and
you might well have.
You
been.
Hadn't figured that out. because, you know, we're... have always been a young faculty.
Yeah,
I always say
true.
It, Alaska's a young people's country.
Yeah.
It's all right
yeah.
to grow old in the country.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's true. It,
yeah.
it still is a young faculty.
I think so.
And
yeah.
Really, I was the... was I the first one... no, Dr. Keller retired before I did. But...
Well, he had a long interruption there
yes,
of his Alaska
yes,
service,
yes,
though.
That's right.
Yeah,
our
total Alaska service, while you were hands up on everybody.
And so, well, I was going to say in this citation, of course, you know, Elmer Rasmussen does the citation for the honorary Doctor of Humanities. And he always has to digress and get a little off the cuff.
Yeah.
And so he was reading the usual things, able administrator and so forth, and my accomplishments. And he said, "And what Lola wants, Lola gets." And of course, this convulsed the audience. But that's the first time I knew that what Lola wants, Lola gets in my case. But anyway, I did have a very wonderful. Time here, and I didn't get everything I wanted, but it was wonderful, the cooperation.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps...
Well, it took a long time coming sometimes, but you were kind of persistent on the needs of the department, and eventually the department had pretty good set.
Well, I think it's a case of looking ahead and knowing what you can get
well,
and when you can get it, perhaps. Well, Bill, now I've done most of the talking here.
I think you've answered all the questions.
You're the
that
historian,
I would have in mind.
And I can't think of anybody who could do a better job than you. And of course, you know what you have always said when people have said to me, "What does Professor Emeritus mean?" And you know, a lot of people don't know.
Yeah.
And a lot of people think you're on the payroll. I always say, well, it means on the faculty without pay.
Yeah.
And you know what you've always said.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Lola, that's not what it means. It means you're out of a job and you darn well deserve it. So,
did I tell that on you?
Yes, you always said that. And so, and coming from you, I thought it was lovely. Because you were one of the highlights. Of course, I don't think everybody knows that... I was a faculty member all the time. You were a student.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know it.
And then you became my colleague.
Oh, that's right.
And so we were colleagues on the faculty for years.
Quite a long time.
And that was true for Woody Johansen, even Ivor Scarlin. And Fred Beeler, and some of those...
And Earl Beistlein.
Earl Beistlein, yes,
sure.
Yes. So there was a great bond with these former students who were my colleagues and my loyal supporters, and I just loved every one of them.
Well, after all, you know, we we were a little indebted to you, too, because, well, we had to treat you good.
I remember when we were holding civil engineering meetings in the Mining Society, and by golly, we'd have to have a little refreshments, so then we'd have to go see you. Well, yes, you can use it to make coffee, and you can do this, but now let's clean it up when you leave, and all this, so we...
And don't forget to close the windows, because the radiator's free. Of course, I got that early train for Dr. Manel, because he went around the building closing all the windows and all the storm windows. And
I almost made it would have been a little facetious this morning. I was over in Jerry Sorensen's office when Dr. Wood came in. And he sat down for a moment, and he said, "No, just sit here." He said, "I just want to tell you, Jerry." And then he called in the newsman, and he says, "Say," he says, "this year, instead of just rambling in front of the faculty at the faculty meeting," he says, "I think I'd like to have a prepared speech." He said, because "I'm given to digressing," and I was almost ready to say, "I agree heartily," or something, but I kept my mouth shut there.
And of course, it's all right for you to digress.
That's right. And then he said, "Well, now, just what do you suppose the faculty coming in, mostly it'll be faculty, would want to hear, especially the new arrivals? The old-timers know pretty much the answer." And so they started tossing suggestions of topics that he should mention, you know, not too much detail on the budget, but some general plan of our operating scope and that side of thing. And I was almost tempted to say, "Now, what you must tell them is to be sure and close the windows and turn off the lights."
we're well schooled in that. Yeah.
Shall we keep on going, or we call it quits?
Well, I was just going to say that we couldn't get along without Cashin's Corner in the...
Thank you.
Yes.
I don't know how long I'll be able to keep up those things, because I'm running out of stories.
You always dig up something.
I'll figure something. Yeah. Well, thank you, Lola, so very much for your time, and we're very... You covered everything that I would have asked you, so I can't think of any other questions I'll have to ask. And of course, I'm not going to let anybody read proof on this book. The first thing you're going to get is when it's all done, because I'll be rewriting it forever. But
right.
Thanks a million for your good time and your good interview. Until a little later, then, so long.